In the studio, I've got Finn Mackesy. Good morning.
Good morning.
Finn is here for our regular / irregular permaculture chat. And we have been working through, or I should say, Finn, you are a permaculturist. And I know to slap one label on people is always tricky when you get to know them, but that'll do for now.
Yep.
And we've been going through the permaculture domains, which is David Holmgren. It's part of his big picture theorizing about permaculture in the world.
So now, it's the permaculture flower is the framework in which the domains arrive from, or how he uses to communicate these domains.
Yeah, that's the visualization. In each domain is a different petal. And we had talked about finance and economics a couple of interviews ago.
Yeah, a last interview.
It was the last interview.
It was.
Okay, all right. So, but that was 5 weeks ago, so that's a little while ago. So yeah, so we felt that there was more to be said there. Mm. Do you think it's relevant to the election? A little bit, but not really.
Yeah, I would say a little bit, but not really.
The permaculture party, the theoretical permaculture party's economic policies would be vastly different, I feel, to...
Yes, they would not even make it as a minor party, I think, in terms of where our current thinking is at around economics. So it is a sidestep. You know, there's outside of, as we talked about before, the Democrats for...
social credit.
There is no real political appetite to talk about a fundamental shift in the way we think about economics. That's at least my perspective. It is relevant to the upcoming elections, but not in a direct way.
I did think it would be a funny idea to have you on as a pundit critiquing the election purely from a permaculture point of view. And in fact, we could do it about everything, all the news of the day, like what would permaculture say about this? Mm. Even the sports results. Warriors didn't do very well over the weekend. What can permaculture do? You'd have something to say about the monocultural grass that they play on, probably.
Yeah, I think there'd be lots of opportunities to both critique and make suggestions about what might a reorientation of our world look like if we were thinking as nature thinks.
Mm.
If you could use that expression.
Yeah, that's a really nice way to sum up permaculture.
Mm.
And I don't remember anyone, surely you must have said it several times, but I don't remember that in the past, just thinking as nature thinks. So, which does beg the question, finance and economics, that doesn't seem like something that nature would think about.
So as we talked about last time,
on the face of it.
Yeah, that's right. So ecological economics is a branch, I guess, of human economics, as it were, you know, a kind of a theory that's come out of academia that is starting to understand more and more with greater, I guess, kind of complexity or sophistication, how nature actually works and thinking about it as an economy in terms of trade and exchange and how systems, living systems, work together to meet their needs.
Okay.
Yeah. And so economics, again, as I stated the last time we talked, is, I think, something quite foundational to living systems. And we have invented this concept of economics more recently to describe a certain type of human transaction.
Yeah.
But if we take the concept of if economics is about trade and exchange and the meeting of our metabolic and biological needs more generally is, you know, one would argue an economy has been at play on planet Earth since, you know, 3 billion years ago or just over that, you know, basically since life.
So a lot of sciences, some science is about creating the theory and others is about discovering it, like maths is about discovering the maths. And so this is about discovering how economies work in the natural world.
Yeah, well, and so my interest from a permaculture perspective is how do we take the lessons from nature and apply them to our lives?
Yeah.
And so I guess there is an applied, but you have to kind of understand before you can apply. So so it probably sits somewhere in that. So maybe it is a little bit of instrumental theory, you know, in terms of how do we take what we're learning about the way nature works and trying to make meaning of that and try to design systems that actually work for the planet and work for people, not like some people, but like all people. And so that's, I guess, where I think the permaculture framing of finances and economics comes in.
Yeah, because the ecological system doesn't work for some species and not others.
Well, I mean, it does.
Or maybe those ones that died out.
Yeah. So there is, you know, this idea of fitness, and not necessarily in a neo-Darwinist sense of fitness doesn't mean strongest or best. It means what's fit for the current context. And so, yeah, in that sense, there is a selection process, I guess, in terms of, but generally speaking, I would say those species that are adaptive and responsive are generally integrated into a larger living system. So, you know, our take on the survival of the fittest or whatever is usually around, usually it's individualistic. So it's about me.
Yeah.
But also it's that sense of about domination or about conquering or winning.
It's brought in the values of like empire culture, I guess you could say, into view. Yeah. Whereas what you're talking about is survival of the most adaptable.
Yeah.
Would be. Yeah.
I think how Darwin saw it.
That's what he was trying to say, but it got co-opted. Yeah, okay. So I've already sent the conversation off into a different direction, but where did you want to actually start today?
Yeah, well, I thought it might be good to take a step back. So we talked about the ethics before briefly, and so earth care, people care, fair share. And if we're looking at finance and economics through that lens, is because most of the time when we think about economics, we're usually talking about money. And I think there's value in stepping back and going, what if we're not talking about money? What if we're talking about, again, trade and exchange? So one of the frameworks that I quite like, or I guess a way of visualizing this, is the seven forms of capital. So if financial capital is the money part of it, what are those other forms of capital, those other stores of value that can be that are used in how we create value and meaning in our lives. And so natural capital is, I think, came from probably E.F. Schumacher. He's the first person I know to use it. But this idea of, Gaia or Earth is this amazing system whereby materials are metabolized through the system. And so we take things like diffuse photons from the sun, and through the miracle of photosynthesis, that turns into stored sugars in trees. And we can cut down a tree and then we have wood. You know, we can cut down a tree and we can build shelter. We can cut down a tree and do any number of things. And so that tree, in this case, the timber, is part of that natural capital. And again, we can think of lots of different things. We can think of metals and
these are the things we call ceramics. We typically call resources.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so that's all part of natural capital. But so is a lot of the iconic Earth's metabolism. So a stable climate, the regulation of temperature, the storage of large volumes of water in the mid-catchment. All of this is part of natural capital. It's all the things that create structure, order, and the materials that we and all other species interact with and use to meet our own needs.
Yeah.
So that's all natural capital. So that's, I think, the foundation of all economies, all societies. You know, without that natural capital, life can't really exist. Yeah. And then on that is, you can think of, I guess, in a human context, is cultural capital. You know, what's all of that, the wisdom, I guess, that's been stored and often encoded and passed down from generation to generation. And these happen, so, you know, natural capital builds over, well, I guess it builds over, you know, weeks, months, years, but it builds over decades, centuries, millennium, some of this stuff. It's long time frame. So when we think about things like fossil carbon, oil, coal, gas that come out of the ground, these happen over geological time periods, you know, hundreds of millions of years. But this is all part of the natural capital. Cultural capital accrues typically over decades and generations. And so, you know, in an Aotearoa context, you know, these are even things like our whakatauki, our proverbs and our sayings that store this kind of deep cultural meaning that a lot of them we still know, but we don't really value.
We don't consciously think of them as being cornerstones of our culture or anything like that.
Yeah.
Like the air we breathe, we don't notice it most of the time.
Yeah, and I don't, and I think they have a different meaning depending on, again, when I don't want to be too loose about when I say culture is, you know, whose culture am I talking about? But say in a Pakeha context is often, you know, there's a lot of these sayings that we've inherited through English culture that back in the day were really valued and prized and actually allowed, I imagine, English people to thrive in a kind of day-to-day basis. But now we still remember them, but we kind of go, ah, that's just an old thing people say. So that's an old thing that some people say, I guess. And so, but that's one example of that. There's lots of, you know, it's our myths. And when I say myths, I don't mean like the false...
made up stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean the ways in which we make sense of the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so cultural capital is this incredible store of value that, again, has served for eons human cultures where they pass on what they learn. And cultural capital is even things like the knowledge we have about how to grow certain foods. But we'll get to that in a different way. Then there's also built capital. So built capital is the stuff we make, the mea mea, the tangibles, the tools.
Yeah.
Our roads, our infrastructure, our buildings are all examples of that. Our digging sticks, our musical instruments, all that's part of built capital.
Yeah.
Social capital is the networks and connections that we have between ourselves. And, you know, incredible, hugely valuable form of wealth, right? And we learn from things like Hurricane Katrina back in the day is, you know, those people that had connections to people outside of New Orleans and particularly people who they could connect with who had ways and means financially, they got out because they had that form of social capital that allowed them to call for help.
Yeah,
and then relations from elsewhere were able to use the resources that they had to kind of extract them out of those situations. And the people who didn't have those forms of social capital kind of got stuck, and often at the detriment of a lot of those people. You know, there was some terrible things that happened to people who couldn't, and that's one form of social capital. So, but social capital is really, really important. And again, we're seeing even things like now with mental health issues and, you know, which at least in part has a correlation to social capital and our
being isolated.
Our ability to access support services and all of that when we're not necessarily able to tap into those directly are the people around us who can help us.
Yeah.
You know, so all of that's kind of forms of social capital. But then there's even just things like, you know, who you know. And word of mouth and being able to access certain things because you know someone who knows someone else.
Yeah.
You know, all of that's part of that social capital. And all of these, I would say, are important considerations when we're thinking about economics, you know, that kind of trade and exchange. We have things like human capital, which is the skills and the experiences that we accrue over our own lifetime.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've got my own store, I guess, of human capital, and you've got your own store, and your human capital can support me with things that I just don't understand and don't know, and potentially vice versa.
Mm.
And so human capital is, again, something that's hugely just kind of taken for granted and assumed. In the market today, it's usually called labor.
But it's not labor, is it? Because it's more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but that's usually how it's...
Sometimes they have that phrase, institutional knowledge, which is like if you look at the council, for instance, all the knowledge that the people there have got, and it's the knowledge they've got as individuals, and if they leave, they lose the organization loses institutional knowledge.
And so I think that's a really good example is, so there's an element there of cultural capital.
Yeah.
Yeah, in that some of that is institutional knowledge that sits in some of those superstructures of those. Then there's the human capital part that we're just talking about. But then there is... knowledge capital, I think, which is this kind of more almost ephemeral, that's not the right way of saying it, they're more abstract type of capital where it's knowledge that a whole bunch of different people can tap into that doesn't necessarily sit within a specific cultural context. And so knowledge capital is another form of capital. So, you know, for example, there might be philosophy might be an example of that, in that at one point it was an individual's human capital, and they probably were able to develop their own understanding or perspectives on life based on listening to other people's written stories of their human capital. But philosophy, anyone can tap into from any place around the world. And so that would be an example. Or, you know, there might be things are in physics and mathematics and science that is part of that knowledge capital that was originally kind of quote-unquote discovered or learned or understood by individuals or groups of individuals, but now in our world is accessible to a much broader audience.
Yeah.
And so knowledge capital is actually, again, quite valuable. But it is vulnerable to loss.
Mm.
And so, you know, things like social capital are as well. You have to continue to, again, using this term, invest in social capital to keep it alive. Yeah, there's very few forms of social capital where we can just let atrophy and they still maintain their value. You know, we have to keep building relationships, keep maintaining our social networks, etc. Knowledge capital is similar but different in that we can accrue all this knowledge, but history tells us that sometimes when things in the system change, that whole knowledge that can be lost. And so, you know, from an archaeological point of view, there's a whole bunch of things that we look back and we go, we have no idea how they did that.
Mm.
Or, wow, what a sophisticated, quote-unquote, writing system. We have no idea what it means. And those are those kind of breaks in where a whole bunch of knowledge capital has been stored, but you can't access it because there's not that continuity.
Yeah. And so then, is that all seven?
No, and then the last one is financial capital, which we talked about at the beginning, and that is
which we should instinctively know what that is, but or do we?
Well, I will unpack it because when we talk about capital today, that's usually what we're talking about. But one of the things that I think is interesting about financial capital is that it is incredibly useful today because currently we can essentially trade and exchange it for pretty much any other form of capital. So it's really valuable in that sense, is I can make up for lack of skills with money because I can get someone else to come in and do those. I can, in the world today, I can kind of, quote unquote, buy friends and social connections and all the rest of it. So I can make up for social capital through money. I can, you know, you can imagine built form. And so money becomes this...
So you could use money to get out of New Orleans as well. If you had friends outside New Orleans, you could just, and you had enough money, you'd go to a hotel.
That's right. So it has this kind of fungibility, this transferability where you can take it from one form to another. But the other side of financial capital is that, similar to knowledge capital, even more so, it is incredibly vulnerable. And so, as you know, anyone who lived in Latin America for the last whatever, however long, would know, is there's a, you know, when your economy plummets and bottoms out, is, you know, paper money becomes toilet paper.
Yeah.
And so how do we, and even today when most of our money sits in zeros and ones on screens, what happens when there's some kind of financial crisis? Those zeros and ones just kind of disappear forever.
Yeah.
And so while it's incredibly useful, it's also really vulnerable to loss.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So where do these seven forms of capital come from? Is this part of permaculture or this from?
No, it's come from, it hasn't, I've seen it used, it's in some permaculture publications, but I don't know where I've got it from, to be honest, but it's something I've played with for years and years,
right,
and I guess tested.
Yeah.
But I know it, you know, I haven't made it up. I do know that.
Yeah. You know, I get that because it feels vaguely familiar. But it seems to be like everything that we can conceive of in our world, material or otherwise, seems to be incorporated into that.
And I guess one of the reasons I'm bringing it up is I think it's useful for people to start thinking about economics outside of just money and the transaction of money. And when we're starting to think, why I like the seven forms of capital is we can start thinking about value and what we value in a new way that allows us to, I guess, maybe think differently and therefore potentially act differently.
I guess the first obvious thing, and this has been a discussion for a few decades now, is all the unpaid work that goes on that traditionally in the past was done by the housewife. Not a term we use anymore, but I'm sort of going back to that. That never it's calculated in GDP, but it was all essential services.
Yeah.
And the people who were out working in the family couldn't be out working if there wasn't someone taking care of the kids.
Yeah.
And keeping all the house functional. So that looks like the first thing that sits outside the economy, but we know that that's work being done.
That's right. And we talked a little bit about this before, is, you know, that kind of the informal economy.
Yeah.
And the huge value that plays. And so there's a British, I guess, historian named David Graeber, who's done a bunch of really interesting work around debt.
Yeah.
Well, he's done a lot of interesting work about it. Yeah. And so one of the things that I found interesting is that exploration of, you know, over time you have this typical move from essentially formal economics to informal economics, or things move from the use of an abstract medium of exchange like money, where everyone agrees, yep, $10 is worth $10 and $20 is worth $20. But in and of itself, those bills have no actual value inherently, right?
Firestarter is the actual physical material usefulness.
That's right. And so, economies for the last 5,000 years have swung between more commodity-based money like Firestarter or tobacco or salt or whatever it might have been that actually have real tangible value to things that have a more abstract value. And when we look at things like the Great Depression, you know, coming on 100 years ago, is the informal economy was primary during that time. That's how those people who were impacted by it, they got by shifting their way of life almost completely back into the informal economy again. So it wasn't about the exchange of abstract notes, but it was things of real value.
So I've got a chicken and I need some wood.
Yep.
We're going to swap.
Yep. Or you've got a chicken and I have medical skills and your child is sick.
Yep.
Yep. And so again, it's not even like an exchange of objects necessarily. It's an exchange of different forms of capital.
And did people start, like, we think of it purely as an exchange between two people, but do sometimes people also go, you've got some chickens, I don't need chickens, but I know someone who does, and they've got something I need, so that...
So what becomes really interesting is Adam Smith's, his premise for, his explanation of where money comes in and why it arose was essentially that example, this kind of mythical barter system that, the idea is that you need money if you're going to have more complicated exchanges like the one you just talked about.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of different systems out there that allow for those more complicated exchange systems. So, you know, here we've got a time bank. That's a really good example of where I don't need to have chickens or healthcare skills to be able to offer the skills I do have and get the things I do need. So I guess the time bank example is a little bit different because we're dealing with essentially services or people's time as opposed to but I think there are definitely ways and means of managing that, and the people would have got as sophisticated as they were able to in terms of trying to manage third-party exchange, but again, you could imagine there is a point in where that does become very complex. Another thing that's worth saying is in a lot of traditional cultures where you know, the economy is very local, the worst thing you could do is even out transactions. So if my neighbor came to my house, or I was out of sugar baking a cake or whatever it might be, and I went to the neighbor's and I borrowed 500 grams of sugar, I would be completely offended to repay that debt, quote unquote, or balance that, it was done exactly one for one. So if 500 grams of sugar were returned, because that what that often communicates is I don't want any further relationships with you. I want this to be transactional, not relational. And so there is something about how do you make sure that there's always overs and unders so that you're always in relationship with each other, because you know, you did me a turn, I need to do you a turn. And I think there's something really interesting in that in terms of how communities stay in healthy relationship with each other. Whereas if it's all transactional, that you're not in a in a relationship in the same kind of way, if that makes sense.
It's like if a friend made some jam and they gave you a jar of jam, you'd be delighted. If they gave you $10 because that's how much it was worth to buy in the shop, you'd be like, oh, what the hell are you doing?
Or same, I guess.
Here's $10, here you go. That's incredibly insulting.
So another one for me that would fit in that same space is having friends over for dinner. And at the end of dinner and on their way out, they go, thanks very much. And they try to give me money for, you know. It's the fact that you're laughing, you know. But that's kind of how we relate to economics in every other sense. And so how do we – so again, what I think is really interesting is even, you know, both of our responses to those examples shows that we have this understanding and appreciation of the informal economy. And we know what the formal economy is because that's assumed to be the economy. And – but they're black and like they don't interact in that.
Is there the social capital getting mixed up with the financial capital in some ways? Because like a neighbor is someone we can depend upon, or or our friends are people we can depend upon, and if we couldn't depend upon them, then there would only be financial transactions. But somehow it's, I don't know how you even theorize about that, but it just feels like the two forms of capital are getting mixed up.
Yeah, and I think – and they are sometimes, you know, blurred and we're not conscious of it. And again, that's why I'm sharing this model of the seven forms of capital, because I think it's useful to start thinking about wealth and value in different ways. And I guess the other point that I do want to make is from, I guess, that kind of permaculture lens of understanding the world in, at least in part through the lens of energy and the role that energy plays in living systems.
Yeah.
And so if we are at a stage now where we are – burning fossil carbons at, you know, something like it's either 10 to 20 million times quicker than they've accrued.
Oh, they've actually calculated. Yeah, it's quite a bit, quite a bit of a difference.
And, you know, so if we're entering or we're leaving this kind of phase of energy abundance that we've been in for the last 100 plus years, is presumably our economy shifts and we move from this consumer economy to what some people respect and think are quite switched on would call, you know, more of the salvage economy. And so what's the implications of that in terms of how we think about value and wealth as we're no longer extracting things as quickly as we can, but we shift to how do we make use of the things that are already around us? And that's where I think, you know, that financial capital lens diminishes significantly and the other forms of capital become much, much more important.
We might feel better about the future if we understand that there are other forms of capital and that we can rely on them if financial capital is not necessarily working for us.
Yeah, and I think financial capital has value and is useful, but not nearly as much as we, you know, we have it drive everything. You were talking about the elections before is, you know, you can't have a serious conversation or been taken seriously in New Zealand politics without having a economy first kind of approach. And I don't know, that seems, as I'm about to say this, it sounds naive for me to say this, but it seems ridiculous. You know, why not have a nature first, a people first approach to politics? And then we have a conversation about, so how do we have an economic model that is going to serve planet and serve people? Not how are we going to have an environment and a culture that's going to serve the economy.
Yeah, I think we are caught up with, and it's almost by accident, trying to arrange the people properly so that the economy can function, rather than trying to arrange the economy so the people can function.
Well, I'd say nature's the same. You know, if you look at how we orient our economics, and if we look day after day, week after week, month after month, the environmental trends, you know, both globally and nationally, you got to scratch your head and go, why are we still doing this? We know the outcomes of what we're prioritizing. You know, we have an increasingly degraded environment. You know, I haven't seen any reports that have suggested that our environment is getting even stabilizing, let alone regenerating. And yet we're still keep doing the things we're doing that are ultimately in service of a quote-unquote healthy economy.
And that's undoubtedly due to the primacy of the financial economy in our lives.
Yep.
And I think it is, like when you were describing at before, the flexibility that it's brought to human lives, I think, has stimulated a lot of, like the growth in, and we say a lot of things, like science over the last 500 years has evolved massively. Mm. But the speed with which things can develop when we have financial capital instead of bartering, for instance, has really stimulated the most astonishing set of activities and growth in the human species.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the last 500 years, there's been more things happen than the previous millions, you know. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing.
It is, and it's not necessarily bad, right? And I think that's what you're highlighting is it's provided some amazing developments. I think we just need to step back, though, and go, at what cost? Because that's what we're wearing now, is the cost of thinking and behaving in, I would consider, quite myopic ways, quite limited ways, towards very limited goals.
But it also does suggest that maybe we can, you know, we've got problems to solve, we need to do them quickly. Mm. Financial capital is probably how we're going to make it happen. It's got to be part of the picture.
My only challenge to that would be, we're now at a stage, you know, we're kind of recently got here, where the largest economy in the world, the United States, creates more debt annually than their GDP. And so when we talk about using financial capital, really what we're talking about is debt, almost exclusively. Because
and we don't have time for the discussion that we're about to embark on, but David Graeber's work and the idea that I keep coming back to the 1935 Labour government that instituted the welfare state in this country, a lot
is
of which
Savage,
most
Savage?
Of which are still here. Yeah, Mickey Savage and John Adler. There were people he was the front man, but there were people pushing him.
Yeah.
It's quite a story. But to get the money to do the state housing, they I think they created the Reserve Bank. They used the Reserve Bank, and it was interest free. Well, no, there was 1% interest which was being charged for the administration of the Reserve Bank and all the work.
Yep.
So money doesn't have to come into existence as debt.
No.
But this
is true. But this is our current mechanism.
But we freak out because people go, it's going to cause inflation. But the key is, where's it spent? And that was spent on useful stuff.
Yep.
We saw through COVID, they threw money at the economy to keep it going. And now inflation has come from that. Yeah, big discussion.
Yeah.
I just like to put that out there because people need to understand that there are other ways of doing things.
Yep. Yeah, and I think we need to rethink economics.
Yeah.
You know, and that's partly why we're having a part two, right? Is because this is such a big topic.
I'm looking forward to part 10. Yeah, yeah, it is. It is. So, folks, if you just joined in halfway through, we're talking to Finn McAsey, who is a permaculturist. Why are we talking about finance and economics? Because David Holmgren, one of the founders of permaculture, quite a few years ago, 20 years ago now, created a new framework, a new theory for permaculture, looking at the whole of everything, I think. And finance and economics is one part of it. Culture is another part. Or was culture and something else?
Yeah, culture and education.
Culture and education.
I think it should be education and culture. Or no, culture and education. I think it's education and culture, but I think it should be culture and education.
Yeah. Okay. More discussion there. But yeah, it's we need to have these ideas around. They need to be around when a crisis happens. And we have a tendency to think a crisis is always coming.
Hmm.
Like the way we get our news.
I listened to the media the other day, mainstream media. And
did you? What'd you do that for?
That's a longer story. But first time I've done that in months. And wow, I could see why.
You felt a sense of urgency to got to do something out of it?
I did feel the cortisol firing in my body. And yes, it was a good reminder of why I don't do that anymore.
Yeah, yeah. So I just wanted to put that in there too, because we are saying we're heading toward a crisis. It's really hard to know.
I think we're heading towards a simplification, and how we manage that simplification will, you know, I don't think it's necessarily a crisis, but I think business as usual is shifting and changing. And so I'm not sure we're heading into a crisis. I think we're heading into a new normal. And I think that's certain given just physics, you know, second law of thermodynamics and what we know about energy and its role in driving nature. But it doesn't have to be a crisis. And I think that's where I get excited about permaculture and why I'm having these kind of conversations, is if we start to be proactive and start to think about, how can we change our systems, not the system, but the, you know, from a grassroots level at an individual, a household, a neighborhood, community scale, then, you know, there is potential to avoid kind of global crises or have them be much less impactful.
I know we tend to respond to a crisis. So what I'm hoping for is small crises.
A wake-up call.
That can be responded to and we step down gently rather than monster crashes. But it's not... Nothing is happening like in my 20s and early 30s, especially my early 30s. I was reading a lot about peak oil and all of this. There's kind of a lot of doomerism on the internet. And it hasn't played out like those predictions were saying. One of our capitals, our built capital and our cultural capital is a lot more sturdy than we realized, I think, than people realized. So
yep.
I don't like making bets on the future now. That's the thing. That's why I think I don't want people to leave this with we've got a nasty crisis coming.
No, I don't think that's true. But I think this century, you know, is changes. I would be very, very surprised if we get halfway through the century without fundamental change.
Yeah. Although we're getting alarmingly close to halfway through the century. We're nearly halfway to halfway.
Yep.
So, yeah. But you're right, yeah. We're going to see some evolution. That's what I hope for, some evolution of who we are. Yeah. All right, Finn, awesome to have you in this morning. And are we going to talk more finance and economics next time, or what's the next domain that we might talk about?
Yeah. I think we might put down finances and economics for now and maybe pick up... we've done land and nature stewardship, so maybe community governance might pick up next time.
Yeah, that's something Ragnar would be interested in, for sure. Yeah. All right, thanks for coming in.